This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Adam Ragusea, in for Anthony Brooks. Sato Tanigawa was the son of a Nobel-winning professor at MIT. Funny and cool and beyond belief smart is how his mother described him. Sato started his freshman year this fall at MIT, but on October 25th, just 5 days before his 19th birthday, his body was discovered in his dorm room dead of asphyxiation.
Nicholas Del Castillo was a sophomore pursuing a math major at MIT, but 3 days before classes were set to start this year, Nicholas retreated to his room and hanged himself.
Two suicides in 2 months. "We're in pain," Chancellor Eric Grimson told The Globe today. "I don't think we're ever emotionally prepared to deal with something like this."
MIT is reeling, but it is certainly not alone. Every year, 10 to 15% of college students seriously contemplate suicide. When a national survey asked universities if they're seeing an increase in the number and severity of students with mental health problems, a staggering 90% said yes.
So today, we're going to talk about it.
Call us. If you're a college student or an administrator, an RA, a professor, or if you're a parent, have you seen this rise of mental health struggles on campus? And what makes those freshman and sophomore years especially so delicate and critical and difficult? What have universities done to help, especially in the past couple of years? And what haven't they done? And overall, how can we move forward to reduce the number of students who might fall through the cracks? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And as always, we are also on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. Well, joining us now is Divya Srinivasan. She is a junior at MIT and co-president of a mental health outreach group on campus called Active Minds. Divya, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much for having me here.
Also with us in the studio is Larry Cohn. He is the director of development at Boston University's Center for Psychiatric Rehabilitation. Larry Cohn, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
Before we get any further, we should state that we did ask members of MIT's administration if they would care to join us today. They declined our invitation. Anytime they do wish to join us, though, we'd be happy to speak with them. So, Divya, let me just ask you, I mean, you're a student, you're a junior at MIT. First of all, what's the mood been like on campus in the past couple months?
Like always, MIT is a great place to be. It's always full of energy and enthusiasm, and I think the past two suicides that our campus has seen have had a major impact on students on campus. I think a lot of us are becoming more aware that mental health is a significant issue, and we as students are responsible for working with one another, which is where Active Minds comes into play. We're a mental health organization on campus, and we serve as a liaison between the mental health institution on campus, MIT Medical, and students. And we really try to foster that conversation between students and between the mental health organization mm-hmm. and students.
What got you to join Active Minds to begin with?
My personal interest in Active Minds started last year. I was looking for an organization to get involved with, and to me, mental health seemed to be an issue that gets largely ignored or gets largely pushed aside because people are afraid to deal with it. There's a lot of stigma associated with students on campus in terms of, you know, reaching out and getting help. And I wanted to be a part of a group that really initiated that conversation and helped students to realize that we're there for one another and we can really provide the support for one another.
So this is peer support, and I want to talk about more about that in a minute. But MIT itself, as an institution, in the past many years, has done a lot to increase the institutional support that it gives for students. For example, I understand that there is basically a health survey that the campus gives to incoming freshmen just to get a sense as to sort of where they are in their state of mind as they first arrive. And then those students who might sort of pop up as being ones that need an extra hand or an eye on or a friend, are the campus sort of psychiatric support checks in with them. So, I mean, this is the kind of thing that wasn't done all that long ago. In your experience as a student, do you feel that university support has increased and has been effective?
University support has been incredibly effective. There are a lot of resources available at MIT. We in particular really help. We try to do our best to facilitate that and make it more accessible to students. I think one thing that might be lacking at times is just student outreach. I think sometimes students are hesitant to really see what resources are there. And I think what we're trying to do is bridge the gap that currently exists between the resources that are available, which are very, very plentiful, and student lack of awareness about how many resources really are available.
Lack of awareness. So when people need help, they may not know where to turn.
Exactly.
Larry Cohn, you're at Boston University, and BU itself has tried to do some pretty innovative things to reach out to students. Can you tell me about one or two of them?
Sure. First, I just want to speak for everybody at BU and give us our heartfelt condolences to everybody at MIT. It's something that's just devastating and reverberates across the river and around to all the campuses. So we're just very sorry for what's happened. So in the last few years, we've got a something called a suicide prevention grant from the Garrett Lee Smith Suicide Prevention Foundation, and we started something called Student Support Network. I shouldn't say we started it. We adapted it from something that was begun at Worcester Polytech, and it's a wonderful program where responding to a statistic that 67% of students who are in distress will first go to a friend and talk about the problem rather than somebody else on campus. So knowing that, what we're doing is we're trying to train students who are volunteering to come to the training to be better at spotting the signs of distress in their fellow students. So we teach them how to look for indicators such as slipping grades or risky behaviors, too much drinking, not sleeping, not eating.
These are pretty I don't know how to put it. These are pretty evident signs when they're dramatic signs. For example, when a student who goes from being, you know, an A, B student, grades slip dramatically down to a D, or there's a long stint of binge drinking where they don't come out of their room for a while. Is there a way to detect before it gets to be so dramatic, the change in behavior?
Well, I think they're not. They may not be as dramatic as you say. You know,
it's been a long time since I've been in college, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I think that something like not coming, not starting to not go to class, you know, just at the beginning, to be able to train students to catch that, but also to teach them to what we're doing is teaching them to be able to respond with empathy, which means not trying to fix the problem when they talk to the student and not diminishing the impact of the problem, but really speaking to them in a way that reflects to them what they're going through and then try to help them get to the help that's available on the campus.
Can I ask you briefly about sort of some of the things that you believe may be driving the fact that there seem to be more students than ever that are either in need of help or seeking help? I mean, I've read many, many studies over the course of the day that point to a sea change in the stresses and sort of emotional and mental state of students.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a 2008 report that said that a national survey of 80,000 college students across the country that said at least once in that year, 63% of students felt hopeless, 93% felt overwhelmed, 91% felt exhausted, not due to physical activity. Almost 80% of them felt extraordinarily sad. I mean, what is going on here amongst college students, right, regardless of what school they're at?
Right. Well, I mean, I have my own opinion about that, and I think it starts with the economy, and I think that students are feeling a lot of pressure and stress to make sure that they're choosing something in school that's going to get them a job right afterwards, because mom and dad have laid out a lot of money, and now that's become a lot more difficult sometimes for them to be able to pay the tuition, so they want to be able to have a job when they come out. But sometimes they're choosing majors that aren't really who they are. And I think that's one stress. Another stress, I think, is that all of the explosion of social media is not always a good thing. Mm. And I think kids are always under a lot of pressure to be on. They text right back immediately, or else somebody's going to feel that they're not, getting back to them quick enough. Or they have to get on Facebook, or, you know, whatever it is, that they always have to feel connected. And that's a big pressure.
Divya, I see you shaking your head yes in response to that. I mean, do these sound like familiar sources of anxiety for students?
Yeah, I mean, as a student, I definitely feel as though we're faced with pressures in terms of post-education career options, as well as the fact that I think as Larry said, there's an explosion of social media, and along with that come a lot of pressures to sustain relationships and build relationships, and there are a lot of issues that can come as a result of being connected to too many things at once. So I think there's just a lot of pressures, both from a social perspective as well as from a career perspective, that are just leading to a lot more emotional stress.
I want to introduce one more voice into this conversation. He is Victor Schwartz. He is a professor of clinical psychiatry at Yeshiva University in New York and co-editor of the book Mental Health Care in the College Community. Victor Schwartz, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks. I'm glad to be able to be with you.
Thank you for joining us today. You've written a lot about this topic, and one thing in particular which I think is quite interesting is that it's another factor that we need to consider is not so much what happens to students while they're in college, but their mental state before they even start their freshman year, that more students than ever who have had mental health issues are arriving at universities than ever before.
That's absolutely correct. And, you know, embedded in some of this very difficult news, and obviously whenever there's been a student suicide, it's a tragic event, and unfortunately sometimes these things do seem to occur in clusters. It has to do with the nature of the community. But a small piece of the good news here is that, in fact, with some of the strides we're making in treatment and really being able to help some young people who might in the past have not been able to make it to college, we're now at a place where some of those folks do, in fact, get to college, although they come with their vulnerabilities and sensitivities and the challenges. And one of the things that concerns many of us is that sometimes when a young person has struggled and overcome the struggles in high school, there's a sense of when they've come to college, well, it's a new page in their life and everything is fine and they don't need to continue treatment, whether that's with therapy or medication, and that sometimes then sets them up for some real serious difficulties.
I mean, these are decisions that at the age of 18 or 19, we are asking or expecting students to make about their own mental health?
Well, and that's, again, one of the serious challenges, that for people coming to college, very often it's the first time they've been really faced with having to care primarily for their own health and their own mental health, where before, obviously, parents have overseen things, schools have very often been very, very involved. But here suddenly the young person is put in the position of having to initiate seeking care in most cases, and that doesn't always happen so smoothly. You know, they don't often know where to go, and they don't always trust the system that's set up to take care of them.
Interesting. So we've heard this information and trust gap a couple of times from all the guests, so I'll talk about that more in a minute. But I do want to ask you, and Larry Cohn as well, does this put colleges in maybe the unfair situation of having to have psychiatric services or being in part a psychiatric institution that's ready to deal or needs to be ready to deal with acute situations that they never had to face before?
Well, I'm not sure it's unfair. You know, in many cases, larger universities function almost as towns or small cities and really need to provide the same sorts of services, and even more so because part of the charge is taking care of the young people who are there to get an education. Really, it's not reasonable to think that somebody who's coming across the country ought to be able to receive care back home when they're, you know, 3,000 miles away from their doctor. So there needs to be a system of care, and we also know that when care is provided on campus, students are significantly more likely to actually seek it out and take advantage of it.
And Larry Cohn, I mean, I've read that there is a standard from, for example, the International Association of Counseling Services that suggests that for every 1,000 to 1,500 students, there should be a ratio of one therapist on campus available for every 1,000 students. Mm-hmm. Now, that seems like, I guess, a reasonable ratio to me that maybe some universities can afford. But what about the colleges and universities that, especially in this economy, can't afford to provide that kind of service?
Well, I mean, it is a big problem. I know at BU they've been able to increase the amount of staff, but they're still feeling overrun by the number of students. In 2010, BU did a healthy, student health services did what's called a Healthy Minds study at BU and found that 36% of students at BU in 2010 felt they needed help for mental health problems in the past year, but 50% of undergraduates felt that receiving mental health treatment is a sign of personal failure. So I think that goes back to what Divya was saying about the stigma that still exists. And I know at BU, one of our really mandates of our grant is to try to change the culture here, mm-hmm. so that for instance, going to see someone for mental health counseling should be as commonplace and natural as seeing the doctor for a flu. But it isn't like that yet, and it needs to be.
Well, we've got a lot of callers who want to join us, so let me welcome them into the conversation. We are talking about the big picture regarding college students and mental health, and this conversation was triggered by the 2 suicides in 2 months at MIT. The problem, of course, is not just at MIT, as we've heard. Campuses across the country are trying to figure out how to support students in their time of need. Sarah is calling from Somerville. You're on the air, Sarah.
Hi, Megan. Thanks so much for taking my call.
You're welcome. What's your thought today?
I just wanted to comment. This has happened to one of my other friends, too. I've been struggling with bipolar disorder my whole life, and before I was diagnosed in college, I went to seek help for my extreme depression, and I was told that my problems were too intense for them to deal with, which really doesn't make you feel any better, and that they couldn't help me, and they didn't even give me, like, a referral to a psychiatrist or anything. And this also happened with one of my friends who was at a college nearby who also has bipolar disorder, and I would just love to hear how you're dealing with people that have maybe more intense diagnoses, because I know a lot of colleges only will do a couple-time treatment.
Sarah, thank you so much for your call. Victor Schwartz, your response to that?
Yeah, sure. It's important to understand that while colleges are trying to provide care for all the students that need, in almost all cases, the mental health care is not billed for, is part of your tuition, is part of your student services fees. As a result of that, there is a need to certain extent, ration care. Also, it's only really within the last 10 or 15 years that colleges have begun to, in greater numbers, really have psychiatrists working at their counseling services who are able to help in managing to take care of people who have more serious problems that need a significant amount of medical oversight. So schools are struggling with how to help students who need more help. One of the things that we all try to do is find, if we're in suburban or urban areas, mm-hmm. working with the university medical centers, working with local clinics who are in a position to provide longer-term care. Those of us who are looking at this on a national front are really very focused on the need for students to have insurance, which now, with Obamacare, becomes more of a generally available thing to young people.
Of course, that is very new and only of the last couple of years.
Correct. So that's helped at least to make care in the community more available to more college students. But schools that are in a more rural setting, sometimes there really are challenges for students to get the care they need. And this is coming back to the question you raised before. If you know going into school that these are concerns and challenges for you, it may be that one of the considerations in choosing a school is making sure that the school does have the array of services mm-hmm. or the network of services out in the community that will allow you to stay healthy.
Let me get another call in here. Elizabeth is calling from Somerville. You're on the air, Elizabeth.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call. I actually was an administrator and worked in student services at MIT for about 3 years and have a lot of personal investment in what they're going through. I have a lot of colleagues who are still there and a deep, deep love for the students and what they're trying to accomplish by achieving their degree. And the pressure they're under is phenomenal. And what I can say is that they have resources beyond any that I've seen at a lot of universities. And I still work in higher education. I have for about 15 years. And the student was absolutely correct. There's a huge, huge stigma around looking for help, especially when it comes to the perception of, oh my God, I can't handle this, or I can't manage my time, or my course load, or my major. And, here's this huge accomplishment of getting into MIT or even just into college, and students don't know how to process it. And
Elizabeth, thank you so much for your call. I want to actually turn that back to our student here, Divya Srinivasan, who is a junior at MIT. This is the second time we've heard, or more than second, that the power of the taboo against seeking assistance when you need it most is enormous. So as a peer-to-peer support group that Active Minds is, how do you try and convince your peers that they should put aside the taboo and get help?
So we've put into place a bunch of initiatives. As Active Minds, we've become very active in administering QPR training sessions. And QPR stands for Question, Persuade, and Refer. And it's kind of a play on CPR for the medical side of things. But what QPR does is it trains students to be active support for each other. And through doing QPR sessions, you realize that it's not bad to ask for help. It's not bad to be a source of help for someone else. And so we've done a lot of extensive QPR training. In fact, we just hosted a QPR session this past weekend in light of recent events. And there was a huge response from graduate resident tutors, a group on campus called MedLinks that helps to provide these services as of now. In addition to these QPR sessions, we also host panel discussions. We try to connect our medical department with students. And additionally, right now we're in talks with our medical department in creating a peer-to-peer support group, sort of like what BU has currently, to really facilitate that interaction, get students to be aware of the fact that they can ask for help.
Larry Cohn?
Two other things we're doing at BU. One is that playing off a very successful Frank Warren website called Post Secret, we developed something here at BU called BU Secret, where we handed out 8,000 postcards, blank postcards, to BU students and asked them to write a secret that they had never told anyone on the postcard. And then we took these postcards that we got back and we exhibited them in around campus at various places so that students can see that they're not alone in the distress that they're feeling, that everybody struggles with things. And then around the exhibit halls, we also posted all the different campus resources where people can go for mental health support. The other thing we've done is we've developed an award-winning website through Student Health Services and the Center for Psych Rehab at www.bu.edu/mentalhealth, where 9 real BU students are interviewed about their particular issue and how they got help on campus. So again, to try to take the stigma away from getting help.
Victor Schwartz, if I can ask you, you know, it's so it's ironic here that a freshman and sophomore years of college are a time where you're thrust into this vibrant new community of a university or a college, but at the same time, it can be an incredibly isolating period of life. I mean, in the case of the two MIT students, they both happened to live in single dorm situations where they didn't have roommates. But even for people who do have roommates, sometimes just making new connections is tough. So I wonder, is it maybe even more aggressive sort of structural change in how we approach the social life of freshmen and sophomores required here to help keep them socially connected, to help keep peers, you know, with their eyes out for each other? Is there something sort of structural we can do here?
I think you've stated the challenge very, very well. It is exciting, and it's also extremely challenging to bring together, in many cases, hundreds or several thousand young people who have, in many cases, very, very little in common. Schools, I think, really work hard to try to find these areas of commonality, whether that may be based on the dormitory setting where you try to create community in housing, whether the people who are teaching freshman English, which is, you know, almost routine in most colleges, really try to create a little bit of a group feeling within classes. I think the chaplaincy services are an important piece of this for students who come from some kind of religiously committed background and for whom that's important. You know, the challenge is to present a multiplicity of options around connectedness and hope that one or two or three of those take hold. I mean, that's a function of teams and intramural activities. All of those things are opportunities for people to be connected. And, you know, the schools are working with the people who are coming in contact with students in those settings, whether they're chaplains chaplains or coaches or people who are teaching freshman writing or academic advisors to help them be really trained to recognize when a student may be in trouble. And RAs in residential schools play an essentially important role.
The training
in that regard, too.
Absolutely.
The training is essential.
I do want to just sneak in one last call in here if I can. Catherine is calling from Cambridge, and I want to get you in here, Catherine, because you're a student at MIT. What's your thought today?
Hi. Yeah, I just want to kind of also contribute to the saying that the culture at MIT can really not focus on mental health. People are always thinking about the next exam, the next problem set that's due, and there's no hard and fast deadline on when a mental breakdown is going to happen, or you even see it day to day, not nearly as extreme as what happened with the two students who committed suicide, but with sleep, with people putting off sleep because they just see their physical well-being as something that doesn't have that hard and fast deadline, and it can be sacrificed.
Catherine, thank you so much for your call. And Divya Srinivasan, briefly, what would you tell your co-student here at MIT?
I mean, it's very real. What she says is very true. You know, on a day-to-day basis, there are so many demands on our time in terms of extracurriculars, schoolwork. What I do recommend my friends, and when we go through situations, is we are generally a support group for one another. You know, if one of us is working too much, we tell the other person to go get some rest. And, you know, between doing an extra PSET problem and getting a half an hour extra rest, you know, you always go for the half an hour extra rest. What I can say is that Active Minds, we're doing our best to really promote wellness and taking care of yourself above the demands on your time, because they will still be there, but your health and safety comes first before you can accomplish anything.
Divya Srinivasan is a junior at MIT and co-president of Active Minds at MIT. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Larry Cohn, director of development at BU's Center for Psychiatric Rehabilitation. Thank you as well.
Thank you for having me again.
Victor Schwartz, professor of clinical psychiatry at Yeshiva University in New York. Great to have you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And listeners, please do continue this conversation at radioboston.org. There's more after the break. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty with Adam Ragusea today. This is Radio Boston.